produced by Jeffrey Cresselius, Preston Frazier, Bill Govier, VR Hoisington, and Wayne Hall. This is Yes Music Podcast episode 369, Peter Banks era Yes videos.
This is Bill Bruford, the ever enthusiastic young drummer from the group Yes, and you're listening to the Yes Music Podcast.
Firstly, I want to say a massive thank you to everyone who's been so incredibly kind to me in recent days, both sending me condolences and wishing me a happy birthday. Every single message has been deeply appreciated. It's at times like these when you realise there are wonderful people out there, and I count you amongst my very closest friends. Thank you. This week, Mark and I have been watching some Peter Banks-era Yes videos, and we'll come back to that in a moment. Also this week, we kicked off the 5% for Something book club in the Patreon group by having a great chat with Simon Barrow, whose book, Solid Mental Grace, Listening to the Music of Yes, is our very first companion volume. If you'd like to join in with that, please do visit Patreon, patreon.com/yesmusicpodcast, or click the button on their YMP website for all the details. This week on Facebook, a lot of the activity has understandably centred around the Cruise to the Edge, where Yes played their first concert, and a lot of other Yes-related happenings took place, and are taking place as I release this episode. There are too many reports and photographs to talk about in depth, but it's definitely worth mentioning the setlist. If you don't like spoilers, fast forward this bit. According to setlist.fm, the band played Parallels, Sweet Dreams, Fly From Here Part 1 We Can Fly, Nine Voices, brackets Long Walker, Clap, Madrigal, Close to the Edge, and You and I, Siberian Katru, and the encore was No Opportunity Necessary, No Experience Needed with Tony K, Roundabout with Tony K, and also with Tony K, Starship Trooper. I'm sure Mark and I will be coming back to this next week, but in the meantime, do let us know what you think of that. In other news, John Anderson is back on Facebook with a new page. I'm not sure why it's a new page. Maybe he mislaid his login details. Anyway, in another apparent technical mishap, his keyboard has seemingly suffered from the caps lock key being stuck down. It could be I'm wrong and John just wants to shout all the time, but what he actually says is pure Anderson. I'll leave you to read it for yourself rather than doing a faintly sarcastic, dreamy John voice here. Essentially, he's on about the forthcoming A Thousand Hands album and concerts, but he mentions in engaging style the Warriors, his northern roots, and perhaps most memorably, his, and I quote, Yes friends Chris Squire, Alan White, Steve Howe. Union 2 is on the way, or maybe not. In other news, lucky young Preston Frazier has spoken to the ever-enthusiastic and generous Tom Brislin, who himself has been entertaining the prog masses in late-night Yes improvisation sessions on that boat. And Daniel Crone talks about the Symphonic Music of Yes album, which contains, as he points out, the only studio recording of Steve Howe doing Owner of a Lonely Heart. Daniel includes that Bill Bruford and Steve Howe promotional spot on US TV, and I'm left pondering whether the album or that performance is worse. Steve also appeared on Eddie Trunk's show Live from the Cruise to the Edge, and Brian Neeson's Prog in the Park advert appeared in the latest issue of Prog magazine. I'm very much indebted to Paul Jacoby for creating a photograph of me standing in front of the topographic ocean, with the fragile planet looming above. That was very kind and great fun. And in the visitor post, John Ginchley, I still don't know how to pronounce your name, John, shared a Steve Howe model guitar for only a few thousand dollars. I'll have two of those, please. John Anderson is keeping the media production for A Thousand Hands in-house by engaging Deborah to create a video, as spotted on Instagram by Meatwood Flack. And Cruiser to the Edge, Joseph Cottrell posted a great shot of Tom Brislin playing with The Sea Within, with Casey McPherson on vocals. Jeffrey Mason shared a recording of that Eddie Trunk interview with Steve Howe, and over on Twitter, the usual myriad of tweets appeared, which I can only skim the surface of here. Incidentally, have you ever tried playing Into the Lens on YouTube at double speed? I think you should. Anyway, on Twitter, as I was saying, Steve Hackett and Jeff Downes had a coordinated wardrobe malfunction. Simon Barrow's Solid Mental Grace account mentioned the mini LP UHQ CDs of the Stephen Wilson Yes remixes, and a certain amount of controversy was created by Clarkson on the Grand Tour, as he carried a copy of the Yes album with him throughout an episode. There's a bit of history of this kind of thing, apparently, with Tony McCabe pointing out the Stig was listening to Yours Is No Disgrace during a lap once, and he said, Rick Wakeman there, what a keyboard player. Or some such. Moving on. Hello to @TracyJ037 and her dad. I hope the box set education is going well. Bill Hayes is reading Simon Barrow's book along with us, and he's even got his own book club to read it as well. Wow! Arkady Schildklopper, no idea how to pronounce that one either, sent me a wonderful chamber ensemble 50th anniversary Yes medley, in which he's playing the French horn, which I've embedded into the show notes for this week's episode. It's great. And John Dee was filming at the side of the stage at the 50th anniversary concert in London. He sent along a short clip of that, and the rest is with Yes Management. Many thanks, as always, to everyone who's been in touch anyway this week.
Olá, sou o Miguel Falcão, de Coimbra, Portugal. Estão a ouvir o Yes Music Podcast.
One of the most interesting images from the various Cruise to the Edge feeds was the photo of Fernando Perdomo at the pre-cruise party playing a replica of Peter Banks's Rickenbacker lead guitar, complete with the Banks-designed original Yes speech bubble logo. You probably don't need me to remind you that Perdomo collaborated with Dave Kirzner on the recent very well-received Yesterday and Today Yes 50th Anniversary Tribute Album, and you can hear our interview with Dave where he talks at length about that album back on episode 361. After seeing that guitar being wielded in formidable style by Fernando, we were inspired to go back and enjoy rewatching some of the 1969-1970 Yes live television performances to remind ourselves of the playing style and sheer wild enthusiasm of Peter Banks. So Mark and I have chosen three performances each, which are all available on YouTube. I'm going to watch something called Improv Live in Wiesbaden. No opportunity necessary, no experience needed, and Looking Around, both from Switzerland. So what's this improvised piece then? Forgotten Yesterdays tells us this concert was at the Big Apple Club in Wiesbaden, Germany, on 26th of August 1969. Peter Banks's diary tells us it was a recording for a TV show, and there seem to be six videos available, but I think only two of them have actual video footage, while the others are audio recordings only. It turns out that this is actually an 8-plus-minute version of Something's Coming, but I'm certainly not going to complain that I think I've seen this before. It's still an absolute joy to watch it again. We begin with some simply brilliant Bruford jazzy drumming spinning around the whole kit and mesmerising in its anti-rock and roll stance. Then we see Squire atypically at the back of the tiny stage and Anderson tapping a tambourine. Kay is coaxing, or rather wrenching, amazing Hammond organ sounds out of the instruments, but perhaps the most energetic and out there, to use a 60s expression, member of the band is Peter Banks, whose practically atonal screeching riffs finally join the rest of the instruments in an emphatic iteration of the main theme of the music, followed in that unique Yes arrangement pattern by a patchwork of other approaches, all of them perfectly timed and obviously rehearsed to within an inch of their lives. It's not just seamless, it's staggeringly precise music wrapped within a deliberate sense of mayhem and chaos, as Banks dances and throws himself around the stage, emphasising every note with extravagant body contortions. Suddenly the texture clears to reveal wonderful vocal harmonies and the opening verse featuring a Yes choir enhanced by Banks's own voice. He appears to be attempting to hit the cameraman at various points as the music flies through section after interlocking section. Banks tries out a whole smorgasbord of techniques, but perhaps the most astonishing aspect is the sheer confidence of the musicians in what is clearly a bewildering song structure. A smile is inevitable when Banks blasts out the Lieutenant Kije theme while simultaneously jumping scissor-legged high into the air. We're very fortunate to have this record of the band, and particularly Banks's part in it. At one point, towards the end, he lies on his back before a scintillating reprise of the material. The ending is infused with Squire blending in Bernstein's Tonight, and with a bashed ending, we are left with the feeling that those of us far too young to have seen the band at the Marquee Club in their residence at least have this video to play and replay half a century later. What a treat. So my second taste of the late 60s Yes, featuring Peter Banks and his iconic white Rickenbacker, is No Opportunity Necessary, No Experience Required, another cover version, but this time by Richie Havens, and recorded for the Beat Club, being broadcast on 29th of November 1969. There's no doubt that this is live as Bruford's snare drum buzzes loudly while Kay begins the ostinato Hammond part. The depth of sound he manages to get from the organ is remarkable, and the shifting frenetic drum and bass patterns contrast beautifully with the smoother, more laid-back Anderson vocal part. This performance is a little bit more staid in its approach, probably because we don't have an audience right in front of the band, as far as I can tell, but it's still clearly a breathless and energy-packed version. It always surprises me that Banks playing the Wild West theme just on his guitar comes over as well as it does, even without the backing of those cascading strings. Banks doesn't quite repeat his previous antics, but that's possibly down to the more controlled situation. It's a short but still adrenaline-packed version, and the Yes logo is projected behind the groups, changing to No at one point in, I suppose, what passed for humour in those days. Finally, I'm letting the VT spool onwards in this TV recording to Looking Around. John Anderson's introduction is hilarious, as the camera catches him suggesting to the band that they tell the audience that the previous song was a Ritchie Havens number, and he then proceeds to do so when he realises the camera is recording and pointing straight at him. He seems a little abashed, which is understandable. He introduces Looking Around, which was of course one of the earliest Anderson Squire collaborations. Once again, Kay starts the party off with an impressive Hammond groove, and this one has a much simpler structure, but Squire still manages to be right at the top of the mix. It goes with a real swing, giving Banks the chance to add small solos in before Squire is back, shaking the foundations of the building. Banks' backing vocals are very strong indeed, but he does seem to be trying to be more integrated into the band, and I wonder if that's because this is an original song rather than a cover version, and clearly this studio setting has a very different vibe to a live club one.
Greetings, friends. So this week, Kevin and I are going to be taking a look at some live videos that involve Peter Banks. So this is obviously music that was recorded, or filmed better yet, back in the late 60s when Peter Banks was still in the band. Each of us are going to be taking a look at three songs from this time period. I'll be taking a look at two songs that were performed on August 26th, 1969 in Weissenbad, Germany, and one song that was done for live television on November 23rd, 1969 on a French television program. So mainly what we're going to be taking a look at is Peter Banks' performance in this, and I guess kind of take a look at what makes Peter Banks different as a performer compared to maybe Steve Howe. The first song on the video that I had to look at was Every Little Thing. Now, just like last time when I believe we did something similar, I'm going to be pretty much having the same opinion on all of the songs because the tendencies that Peter Banks has as a guitar player seem to appear on all the songs that he does. So I'll go through each song and kind of point out little things that I've noticed in each performance, and you'll notice that there'll be some overlapping things from song to song. So for Every Little Thing, I put down the following. It's a very flamboyant performance. Lots of kicks and arm windmills. Very different on stage from the other guys in the band, especially. John and Chris seem very much more reserved on stage, very much more focused, where Peter Banks seems to have a more rock guitar player approach, very much active on stage. And like I said, a lot of kicks and windmills and getting into it a lot more than John and Chris seem to. With that said, it is a lot more exciting to watch than watching John and Chris, obviously. But with this excitement also comes the fact that it takes away from some of the accuracy of his playing. A lot of the times he'll be doing parts and you can hear him, you know, bending notes out of tune or just missing parts. Not horribly, but just missing sections here and there, missing little notes that probably he wouldn't have done if he had more attention to their performance. And with that said, he also has some really cool parts that he does. He's very good at the use of his volume pedal. In this song in particular is a middle section breakdown with a really nice single note passage that he accents with his volume pedal, which I think is really well done. He's very good at that sort of technique. And the other thing that I found very strong on his part is that he's a really good singer. He harmonizes very good with John and Chris. And to be honest with you, I think that if they had doubts about getting rid of Peter, this would probably have been the main stickler point, I think, as to maybe considering keeping him on, is because he is a strong singer. In comparison to Steve, I think he's a much better singer. So while they lost a better singer, people would argue that they gained a better guitar player in Steve. So the next song that they performed on here is Something's Coming. Again, there's some really nice improvising on his part. Not very much in the style of Steve. Like, Peter does more kind of rock, blues kind of improvisations, whereas Steve Howe seems to branch out a lot more and go into different types of music in his improvisations. Lots of jazz influence and stuff like that, where Peter doesn't do that. Another thing I noticed as well is sometimes his tuning seems questionable on stage. This is something that Steve Howe, I'll give 100% credit for. Never have I heard a performance by Steve Howe where his guitar was out of tune, like ever, I don't think. There might have been, I think, a part in the Glastonbury video that I saw a few years back where there was a tuning issue, but I'm not sure if that was Steve. But in any case, Steve Howe is very much a stickler for tuning, much more than Peter Banks obviously is, because he pretty much went through parts of songs with the tuning just being very questionable. Again, in this song, I noticed that he has another energetic performance, lots of kicking again, and lots of windmilling and hand gestures. Again, he does some really nice volume pedal stuff, again with the single notation sort of lines. And again, he shows some very good singing. Again, this is something that really sticks out, especially in this song. He has some really nice back and forth vocal passages between John and him. But the part that really killed me in this performance, though, is there's a section in the song where he starts rolling around on the floor. It almost looked like, you know, like Curly from the Three Stooges. It kind of made me start laughing. Definitely not a sort of Yes-type performance. You know, honestly, I think that that's probably one of the things that became quite the stickler with the other guys, especially John and Chris. I think that they felt that this was something that they were not too hip on. And it really kind of took away, I think, from the attention to them, which, you know, might have been an issue, because I think those guys wanted to, you know, have focus on them as well, and maybe with Peter's antics, there wasn't as much of it on them. So I'm convinced that this is one of the reasons why they replaced him. And I also think that that had an influence on Tony Kaye. A lot of the organ rocking and antics that he did was kind of done at the same time when Peter was doing it. I think they kind of fed off of each other. And maybe that's also why he wasn't very happy once Steve came in, because Steve definitely didn't do any of these things. And he sort of lost a partner on stage. So I think that maybe for Tony, it started getting a little too serious on stage for him. And maybe the fun started disappearing. So maybe Peter brought that element of fun on stage. And that's maybe another thing that they lost with Peter Banks leaving. I'll also say this then. I think Peter Banks on album is fantastic. A lot of his guitar parts are really good. I love his guitar tone on record. And, you know, his tone live is pretty good as well. But again, I don't think he's nearly as accurate on stage. And I think that's something that somebody like John and Chris would have noticed and probably would have took into account with the grand scheme of his employment. So the last song that I looked at was Beyond and Before, which was on this French TV appearance. Now, Peter's performance on this is much better. I'm not sure if it's because he might have already been given some notice about his antics to maybe cool it down a little bit, but it was much better, much smoother. His tuning was better. His performance was better. Yeah, sure, he did still some of his little kicks and windmills, not nearly as much. It was much more toned down, but I think it was for the better. He played better. A lot of his parts that he did, including those volume pedal parts, sounded really good. And getting back to this volume pedal thing, I used to always think that this was a Steve Howe thing that he used to do a lot, and I thought that was something that he brought to the band, but obviously not. This is something that I think Peter had in, obviously, long before Steve came in, and maybe it's something that Steve picked up on and continued doing for the rest of his tenure so far with Yes. So maybe Peter had something to add into the style of guitar playing when it comes to Yes. So that's my look at these three songs. Again, from song to song to song, pretty much everything kind of crossed over because he was a very animated player and those things always appeared in his performances. Obviously, for the last one here, I didn't get into too much detail because, again, I would have been repeating a lot of what I said earlier, but saying that, this last performance is probably the best one that I've seen of him. Again, he did a great job. He really kind of seemed to focus more on playing things more correctly, and probably being on television made him want to give a much better performance in that sense. So let's go over to Kevin and talk about this further.
So right back to 1969 then, listening to and watching Peter Banks, and he certainly is an amazing person to watch. And Mark is with me here now. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin.
So I really enjoyed listening to your piece about the videos that you watched. And in fact, I think one of the videos we watched was the same one. It was just labelled differently, well, slightly annoyingly. But anyway, it doesn't matter. As you say, Peter Banks, flamboyant. I thought that was a very good way of putting it. And I was fascinated to hear some of the things that you said about how he, over that stage, and I think we've mentioned this before, over at that side of the stage, so stage right, with Tony Kaye, and the two of them being fairly wild together, weren't they?
Yeah, it very much seemed like they fed off of one another when it came to live performance.
And over the other side, it's as if there were two camps going on. And that's not something I've really focused on very much, but after you said it, that it does occur to me that that could be the case. I mean, you've got, it's a bit of a war in some ways, wasn't it? Because you had Chris Squire trying to be louder than everybody else put together over on stage left, and then these two on the other side being absolutely crazy as well, and John Anderson in the middle singing beautifully, of course, and Bill Bruford at the back. Now, something which it did occur to me when I was thinking about this was I had a look back at the first album, Yes, simply called Yes, of course, and the second album, Time to Word, the only two albums on which Peter Banks actually recorded, and he has no writing credits on either of those two albums. So as far as I'm aware, and somebody will tell us if I'm wrong, there are no Yes songs with a Peter Banks writing credit. That really surprised me.
Yeah, I mean, I found that kind of surprising as well, because it seemed like, as far as his involvement with the cover songs that they did, I know that he said that he had a lot of input on that as far as making them sound nothing like the originals, that was something that him and Bill Bruford saw very much eye to eye on. So I always thought that his input on that was interesting, because those songs always turned out to be very, very well done. And definitely didn't sound like any of the original. So I would assume that he had very much to offer as far as songwriting goes. And I mean, later on with his own material and even with Badger and stuff like that, he definitely proved that he had a lot to offer musically as well.
Yes, it'd be interesting to, and let us know if you know, please, to know exactly how much of the Mabel Greer's Toy Shop material he wrote. We'll have to investigate that as well. And certainly an amazing character live, as we've said. But I spotted what you did as well very, very distinctly. The massive differences between the live with an audience recordings that we've got, where he did seem to be just completely all over the place and histrionics lying on his back and playing and such some amazing antics. And the studio recordings, which were recorded for broadcast on TV, but totally different situations. And certainly Peter Banks seems to be a very different character in those two situations.
Yeah, I've like I said in my piece, I think that Peter Banks on record, as far as studio recordings go, he's done some fantastic work. I really love those first two records. It seems like as years go by, I like those albums more and more even. But he's, as a guitar player myself, watching him in a live environment, I mean, it's definitely entertaining. You can't say that it's not. Yes. As far as being an audience member. But the musician in me that watches him kind of sometimes does like that old cringed face when you hear a few of those out of tune notes that he bends, because, you know, he's on his back like, you know, Curly from the Three Stooges. They're trying to do some kind of, you know, Curly shuffle or something on the floor while he's trying to play these songs, which are not exactly simple to play. So I just find it interesting that, like, he was, you know, in some of those videos, he'd be doing these kicks, like, you know, Rockettes kind of style kicks. And, you know, these arm twirls. It's just, he definitely tried to keep the show entertaining, but I think his own performance suffered for it.
Yeah, that was fascinating. I was amazed that you had picked that up. And the only real way that I picked that up is where he does seem to go off key. But I had assumed that was deliberate, and that was an improvisation, and it was deliberately off key and then back into key again. But you did actually notice some imperfections in the way he was playing, and that couldn't be more removed from Steve Howe's approach, could it? I mean, he's always prided himself on the exact, precise nature of his playing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And that's one thing that really stood out to me, too, because I remember there was a piece that Steve Howe did on a documentary where he was talking about, you know, his guitar and how if it wasn't properly tuned and set up properly, that it was a disaster in his eyes, you know, that he couldn't perform at its top, you know, capabilities. And to me, you know, you hear stories from Peter Banks saying that he threw up his Rickenbacker into the ceiling and it got stuck in there, and he'd pull it down, the tuning pegs were all bent and he couldn't tune it anymore. And I mean, this is some total night and day, you know, stylings as far as how they even keep their instrument. I mean, Steve Howe would never allow himself to play out of tune. Meanwhile, Peter Banks would go through, you know, parts of songs like wildly out of tune, it seemed. I mean, some of those sections that I watched, there was a part in there that I'm pretty sure he was out of tune a little bit.
Yeah, it is fascinating. And when you see that, there was a very recent on social media, somebody posted a photograph, and I can't remember who the two musicians in the photograph were, but there was Peter Banks' original Rickenbacker with the Yes logo on it, which he'd presumably painted himself on it. And it's in a right state. It's that there are splits in the wood and it's all bent out of shape, literally. And not for the same reason as that triple neck, which originally started off in one of Rick Wakeman's bands, didn't it? And then it was passed on to Chris Squire. But then that got destroyed because the necks warped and you just couldn't play it anymore, which is why he gave up playing the original one, I understand. But this, as you say, this original Yes guitar was damaged by Peter, you know, in the process of playing it, which is quite remarkable. I do love the energy he puts into it. And as you say, those performances were real crowd pleasers, and you really got the impression that you were there. And I'm absolutely delighted that we've got some of this footage of Peter Banks doing these things. And it would be terrible if we had no way of reliving that.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it is an important part of Yes history any way you look at it, because, I mean, to me, it represents a crossroad for them, because they could have went one way. They could have went to Peter Banks' way, kept them, you know, and went for a more rock and roll approach, I think, overall. And not only in just the songwriting, which was definitely a bit more rockish than they went when they had Steve Howe in the band, but also in the style of performance, too, because you had, you know, Tony K rocking that Hammond organ back and forth and, you know, going crazy on his side along with Peter, you know. And maybe if they decided, okay, you know what, maybe Peter's onto something, maybe we would have had a crazier Chris Squire, or, you know, maybe you would have had John Anderson, you know, throwing tambourines in the air, who knows, maybe he would have just went more that way. But instead, I think that definitely they found these things annoying, I think, at some points, because you would even, I swear that when I watch some of these things, you can see it in John's face that he kind of looks at it and doesn't seem amused sometimes with these things. And I think that it was an issue with why they let him go.
Yeah. He certainly did want to go a different way, it seems. Now, what can you tell us about Flash? I mean, I have listened to a little bit of Flash. I can't say I'm an expert in Flash, but is that where he really came into his own, Peter Banks, and he was able to do those crazy antics and really take the music in that direction?
Well, I love Flash. I have their albums. I really enjoy the music. It's definitely more, it's technical still, but it definitely has a lot more rock elements to it. But I think it's definitely more in the style that he was trying to maybe lead Yes towards, where it was, you know, let's make long songs and technical songs, but let's keep a kind of rock and roll feel to it. I mean, his guitar sound is way different than Steve Howe's. It has a lot more overdrive to it, and there's a lot more happening in, like, the sense of that there could be feedback and stuff like that going on. It's just definitely a more, let's put it this way, he has more to do with, like, a Jimi Hendrix and stuff like that, whereas Steve Howe had more to do with maybe like Chet Atkins, you know?
Yeah. So I can definitely see that. And interestingly, I read a little bit of John Kirkman's dialogue interview with Peter Banks. And he did say, I think, in there that there was a certain amount of compromise, he thinks, in those early albums, because they did have to come up with short songs, with fairly simple songs. And he mentioned the fact that John Anderson was a massive Beatles fan, and perhaps he wanted to go in that direction. And then, as you say, there's this pathway, isn't there, between the first two albums and that lineup, and then moving into eventually the Fragile and the Close to the Edge lineup, where both the keyboard player and the guitar player change, and those players change, as you've already said, for specific reasons, not just because he was over the top on the stage, maybe, and the others didn't necessarily like that. And I think that's a reasonable comment. But because, as you say, the direction that the rest of the band wanted to take it was in that more progressive direction. And of course, like we said some time ago when we talked about Tony Kaye and his undoubtedly fantastic early contribution to the band, there is no way that even the Yes album, and certainly not Fragile and Close to the Edge and Tales from Topographic Oceans, couldn't have happened with Peter Banks in the band, could it?
No, not at all. It's just not his style of playing. Let's put it this way. They could have maybe written songs in that style. He probably wouldn't have been comfortable doing it. And I think it would have been kind of pulling teeth for John and those guys to get him to play along, so to speak, as far as that. But it's just not his style of writing. I mean, that's the one thing that Steve brought that is kind of absent from Peter, is that he had all these different kinds of guitars that he brought. He brought the lap steel. He brought all the, you know, the Portuguese guitar, the acoustic guitars and stuff like that. I mean, that's one thing that's kind of interesting, is that I don't recall in any of the stuff that Peter did with Yes, him ever playing an acoustic guitar on anything, I don't think, on the records. Whereas Steve has it all over the place, classical guitar, acoustic guitar. He has that little Portuguese guitar. I mean, there's a picture of Steve with his guitar collection. It was just massive. Yes. I don't think Peter at that time had more than maybe two guitars with him.
Yes, there is that. Yes, there is that story, isn't there, about somebody else. Now, I'm racking my brain and people will be, listeners will be shouting at the speakers trying to remind me of the song where Peter Banks was irritated that somebody else came in and played the guitar part. So someone from
Time and a Word.
Was it Time and a Word? Yes, played that acoustic guitar part. But yes, you're right. And I think that was what part of the essential progression of the band towards progressive music, if you see what I mean, which was to widen the palette of sounds that they were capable of producing. And of course, there was that intention to get the rock band to sound as much like a whole symphony orchestra as they possibly could, with John and various others being very keen on classical music. And so that went for the keyboard, so bringing Wakeman in with his much wider palette, and also bringing Steve Howe in with his, as you say, great big collection of guitars and his ability to play in different styles, classical styles and jazz styles, as you've already said. And this was part of the progression, and unfortunately, a bit like Tony Kaye, Peter Banks just wasn't able to go with the band on that journey, even though I and you have already said that we've really enjoyed watching these videos this week. So, yeah, absolutely wonderful to have those, and great to watch them this week. And as you say, it's a real essential and important part of the Yes story, but there's no way that Peter Banks could have really gone on that journey with the band.
Okay, yeah, so absolutely. As much as he wouldn't have been able to go down that route, it's very important that they went down the route that they did with Peter, because again, you need a foundation to start from. And I think that their first two records are fantastic records. They showed signs of what was to come, but it definitely had its own identity and stamp to it.
Absolutely. Okay, well, as usual, don't take our word for it. Let us know what you think about Peter Banks and those earliest days with the band. Could he have continued? What's your opinion? Let us know in the show notes for this episode. For the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're welcome, Kevin.
This is Two Pence with Mark Anthony Kaye and Kevin Mulrine.
So, returning to Two Pence this week, and this time we're going to talk about Cruise to the Edge. Mark is still with me. Hello, Mark.
Hello there, Kevin.
So I've just got a short Two Pence for us this week, and we're waiting to hear what Yes are actually playing on Cruise to the Edge. It's happening exactly the same time as we're recording this episode, although I think it's probably going to be finished by the time we release this episode. We shall see. I haven't heard yet what Yes are playing, so we're going to play the game of what one song would we really like Yes to play on Cruise to the Edge. So have a think about that, Mark. We know that the band are all there. Jay Shellen is there, and we know that Tony Kaye is there as well. So, go on then, Mark. If you could choose just one song to add to their list, maybe they'll be playing it, maybe they won't, what one would you choose?
Well, I know I've mentioned this song a few times before, and I think that given that you have Tony Kaye on there as well, and that you have Jay Shellen on drums, I mean, I think it's a song that would have to be easy enough. Well, not, I wouldn't say easy, but easier enough for these people to learn so that they could all play it, and memorable enough that it's something that would kind of stand out to people who are watching, especially these are diehard fans that go on these cruises. So for me, I would say I'd love to hear them do To Be Over from Relayer. I think it's such a great song. And it's a song that they've never done really as a whole band since the Relayer tour, I don't think. So I would love to see them do it. I think Tony Kaye could easily do it with them if they wanted to. And I think it's, you know, still simple enough that if they wanted Alan to maybe participate in it, he probably could do this one. Whereas songs like, you know, Sound Chaser and Gates of Delirium would be probably out of his range of playing now.
Mm-hmm. Excellent choice. Yes, that would be great to hear and, you know, fulfill some of the fans' desire to hear more of Relayer. And one day we hope, fingers crossed, the whole of Relayer. Who knows what will happen in Japan when they get there this year. Mm. So, yeah, that's a great choice. Now, I'm going to surprise everyone because you would imagine that I would say something like, oh, I don't know, Circus of Heaven or Onward or Release, Release. very much the Tomato type repertoire, but I'm not. I'm going to say something that I said on Twitter recently, and it might shock you, might surprise you to hear that I would actually like them to play Open Your Eyes. Now... Because wow. I think that really came over rather well. And I think I agree with Bob Seska. Now, Bob that we had on a few months ago, wasn't it now, talking about his work on the Magnification album, on the sleeves of that, and the Symphonic Live DVD and all that sort of thing that he did, and travelled around with the band and had some fascinating stories to tell us about the band during that era. And I agree with him that there is that period of the band which is very much underrepresented now. And it's that era sort of between 91 and 2000 and, well, present day, I suppose you could say. But there's that era which is underrepresented in live concerts. And I think it would really bring something very different. You've got Billy Sherwood there. I'm sure he'd be delighted to play that song. And I think it would shake up the set list quite a bit.
Oh, yeah, I would definitely... make people kind of perk up their ears for sure, because I mean, it's a record that we know Steve Howe isn't too fond of.
Yeah.
But I think people like, you know, Billy Sheer would have a great deal of fondness for.
Yeah.
And so I think it's a very interesting selection, and one that if I was in the audience would be overjoyed to hear, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah. And it would remind me of my first live Yes concert as well, of course. Now, the only thing we do know for definite about the Cruise to the Edge is that Owner of a Lonely Heart is not going to be played, because Jeff Downes said that it wasn't part of the repertoire, the live repertoire at the moment. So that's fascinating. But as usual, waiting with bated breath to see exactly what they are going to play and whether or not. I mean, I'm assuming that Tony Kaye will be playing because he's there on the cruise. We've seen photographs of him and Jay Shellen, as well as the rest of the band. And fantastic to see some really nice pictures of Alan White, particularly there, again, on the cruise. Fantastic to see that. All right, so you'll be first to know when we know what the set list is. I'll get onto setlist.fm and also onto forgotten-yesterdays.com. I always forget the hyphen when I give that web address out. And we will see exactly what they are playing. But for the moment, thank you very much indeed, Mark.
You're welcome, Kevin.
I've heard all Yes Music podcasts every week. I love to hear what Kevin says. I've heard all Yes Music podcasts every week. I love to hear what Kevin says.
So just before we go, here's the patron update. Yes Music podcast producers are Jeffrey Griselius, Preston Frazier, VR Hoisington, Bill Govier and Wayne Hall. And Yes Music podcast patrons are Aaron Steelman, Scott Smith, Lobate Scarp, Bob Martellotta, Simon Barrow, Mark Zarkle Bags, Brian Sullivan, Sonic Bond, Mark James Lang, Chris Bandini, Steve Dill, Michael O'Connor, Craig Estenes, Steve Rode, Miguel Falcao, Dave Owen, Steve Scott, Neil Caffrey, David Hayden, Steve Raw, Paul Hales, David Pannell, Terence Sadler, Paul Tomei, Dave Watkinson, Tim Stannard, Paul Wilson, Dem, Todd Dudley, Peter Herndon, Fergus Cubbage, Walter Lynn Mosley, Rachel Hadaway, Fred Barringer, William Hayes, Robert Nasa, Jeff Bailey, Guy DeRome, Scott Colombo, Jeffrey Mason, Henrik Antonsen, John Holden, Jamie McQuinn, Ian NB, John Parry, Jeremy North, Lind, John Thompson, Jim, Ken Fuller, Joost Maglef, John Cowan, Keith Hoisington, Joseph Cottrell, Mark Gelberg, Doug Curran, Steve Perry, and also thanks to Robert and David, as usual. So thank you very much indeed to all those patrons. If you'd like to join in with that, have access to lots of exclusive content and activities, and at the same time,
help to support the podcast financially, please do head over to Patreon, patreon.com/YesMusicPodcast, or click the link on yesmusicpodcast.com. So that's all the time we have this week. Thanks so much once again for listening. We'll be back next week, I do hope. But in the meantime, please do keep listening and getting involved by following the podcast on Twitter, on Facebook, or on Instagram. So until next week, just remember, whatever your progressive rock question, the answer is yes.